Henry VIII ascended the throne of England. After he married Catherine of Aragon and was excommunicated by the Pope for divorcing her and remarrying, he formed the Church of England. Throughout the country, chaos broke loose. There were divisions, there were fights between the Catholics and the Protestants as England tried to determine what course it would take. In a nunnery, just outside of London, there was a nun by the last name of Axtell. She led a revolt within the nunnery, and after much work, the entire nunnery became Protestants and left the nunnery. At the same time, across town, there was a monastery. One of the monks there was her brother, also named Axtell. He did the same thing, taking the hint from his sister, led a revolt, and they also left the Catholic Church and became Protestants. These were the earliest background of my mother's family. A century later, Oliver Cromwell overthrew the royalty of England. He brought in the Puritan cause, and one of his lieutenant colonels in the army was Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Axtell. Daniel Axtell was the uncle of my ancestors. Daniel Axtell was very prominent in the revolt against Charles I, the King of England. When Charles I was executed, it was Daniel Axtell who was in charge of the execution party and oversaw the beheading of Charles I. But the royalists soon got the victory, and Cromwell was thrown out. As a result, Daniel Axtell was put up for trial for treason. He was found guilty. He was hung, quartered, the remains of his body scattered to the winds. At his trial, and just before his execution, he was asked for any last words. He offered a prayer. A beautiful prayer. A prayer of forgiveness for those who were executing him. A prayer for the country. And a prayer that, for his own security, feeling safe in his relationship to the Lord as a Puritan. Soon the persecution against the former Puritans, the present Puritans of that time, sister of the Axtells, were exiled to Sudbury, Massachusetts. There they lived for many years before migrating to Ohio and eventually to the northeastern corner of Iowa, many around Edgewood and Strawberry Point. It was in Strawberry Point in 1908 where my mother, Martha Axtell, was born. But now, let me go and talk about my father's side of the family. The name Hagensick comes from two words, Hagen, city in Germany, and Zick, which was a word meaning a resident of the area of Hagen. Therefore, they were originally residents around Hagen, Germany, in the center of the country. However, they soon migrated down to Bavaria, and Bavarian Alps is where the family grew up. In the mid-19th century, the family came across in four or five different migrations to northeast Iowa. My part of the family, Matthias Hagensick, settled in a little town of no more than 50 people, called Sears, Iowa, in the corn country. There he had five wives, one after the other, they all died on him, and these wives produced over 20 children. Number 16 in the group was my grandfather, J.L., or John Lewis Hagensick. John Lewis bought a farm in Clayton Center, Iowa, about 15 miles distant. There built his farmhouse, and soon was hopping the fence to a neighbor's farm, where he met Frieda Deers. They became married. John Lewis and Frieda had four children. Ada was the oldest, born in 1903. Then there was Amos, 1905. My father, Milton, was born in 1908. And the youngest one was Lloyd, born in 1913. Ada was married to a local farmer named Adelbert Wickersheim. His sister, Ruth Wickersheim, married Amos Hagensick. So their sister and brother marrying a sister and brother. The relationship was complicated. My father married Martha Axtell, and my uncle, many years later, married Elizabeth Dogallo. In 1914, the country around Clayton Center, Iowa, was farm country. The local town for grinding the mill was a little village called St. Olaf. St. Olaf had many Bible students. Among these Bible students was Mary Rogers, soon to become Norby, who was daughter of the postmaster of the town, and Harvey Nosby, who was the master of the grain mill. He owned the grain mill. My grandfather would take his grain to be ground at the mill, and Harvey Nosby witnessed to my grandfather about the Bible study message. My grandfather had been a staunch Lutheran, an elder in the Lutheran church, a trustee of the church board. Also, he opened the first store in the town of Clayton Center and was the postmaster of the city. My grandfather got sufficiently interested to buy the six volumes of scripture studies. He brought them home, showed them to Frida, his wife. She took these volumes and threw them in the furnace and burned them up. He was still intent on learning more about these books, so he bought a second set. This set he hid in the barn, and after chores he would read in the barn, in the volumes. My grandmother decided he was taking too long doing his chores. She sent my father, 8 years old, out to the barn. And there my father found these 6 volumes of scripture studies. He brought them in the house, into the furnace, and they were burned. No wonder there were 8 million volumes sold. He went back and bought a third set of volumes. This time he did a better job of hiding them. My father couldn't find them. My uncles and my aunt couldn't find them. And yet, my grandmother figured that her husband was spending far too long in the chores. So she said, Louis, she called him Louis, I know you've got those books in the barn. Bring them in the house and burn them. Nope, won't do that. I demand they be burnt. They're causing problems in our house. They are not what the Lutheran Church teaches. I won't burn them. He sensed some trouble is coming in the marriage. He said, I'll make an offer. I'll bring them in the house. Together we'll read them. And if after reading all 6, you say burn them, I promise I will burn them. So he brought the 6 volumes into the house. And they began reading. And within a month he turned to him and said, Louis, do you know what this means? This means we have to leave the church. And she led my grandfather out of the Lutheran church. At that time in St. Olaf, there was a nice little class. These class were there for the next 2 years while Brother Russ still lived. Probably up to 20, 25 in the class. They had conventions every year. The speaker of the day that my father was born was William Wisdom. He spoke on Sunday at the class, one of the pilgrims of Brother Russell. But after Brother Russell died, and Turmel took over the society, and the brethren went many different ways, the St. Olaf class entirely, my family included, went with what is called the Stand Fast Movement. This was a group of brethren who believed firmly in the writings of Brother Russell, including Volume 7, which they took as gospel truth, and they studied Volume 7 extensively. They thought the high calling was over in 1914, and that they were just to stand fast until they were taken. Witnessing was a thing of the past. They formed quite a large segment of the movement. There's perhaps 300 or 400 associated with the Stand Fast Movement. In fact, there are more than that, closer to 500. Several of them decided to form a commune on Victoria Island off the coast of Vancouver, Canada, in a little place called Souk. The entire class from St. Olaf sold their farms and went to Souk with 3 exceptions. My family, my sister Frida Engelhardt, and Bert Cousins and Adele. Bert and Adele were going to go to Souk and eventually did, but they wanted to wait until my father's firstborn was to be brought home from the hospital. I was that firstborn. And so they waited until I was born, and then they also moved to Souk to this colony of Bible students. The Stand Fast Movement thrived for many years in Souk, and eventually the little colony could not make a living together, and they broke up. But when they broke on very equitable grounds. Assets were evenly divided. All of them were able to find jobs, and there was no great harm done to them through this movement. Gradually, the movement died out as the members died out. I had the privilege in 1960, that's offside, to meet Bert Cousins. I'd gone to the Northwest on a train trip organized by the Alfred Burns and many brethren. And when we were in Bellingham, Washington, I went to see Bert. And Bert told me the time, after we'd had many hours of fellowship, he said, if I knew the Bible students would come along with the same spirit of knowledge you have, I would not have believed the door was closed. I don't know whether it could change or not. Some of the names that were associated with the Stand Fast Movement at that time were names such as the Rice family, Gilbert Rice and Norman Rice, the Livermore family, Livermore now in Israel, the Diebert family, the 2 Parsons families that were so active in the early Portland ecclesias. These were all part of this Souk movement. In 1933, my parents were married, and I was born in 1934, September 17th. 4 days later, my mother died of peritonitis, contracted in childbirth. So I never knew my mother personally. Brother Vance of Minneapolis, Minnesota, held the funeral for her, and it was a Stand Fast funeral. In 1939, we took a trip to the Northwest
to visit brethren from the Stand Fast Movement. On the return trip, we stopped in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and then we visited Brother Nosby that brought our family to the truth, and his nephew, Leon Norby. And Brother Norby began talking to my father and my uncle about the high calling being open. Within a year, he had them convinced that they were wrong on that point, that the door was open and the high calling was still available. They were immersed in 1941. In 1941 also, I was now about 6 or 7 years old. My grandfather died. The bedroom next to one I was in. In 1943, I was in the front yard of our house playing croquet, and I went in to get a glass of water, and I saw my grandmother laying on the floor, telephone in her hand. I quickly called the neighbor over. My father was out in the garden, and the neighbor came over. He asked me to put a little water on her head, get it. What he meant was damp on a cloth. I got a glass of water, poured it over her, anointed her with water as a young child. But it was too late. She was dead. The telephone was with my Aunt Ruth. She had been on the phone with Ruth, and Ruth had heard it. She had also called my father. Couldn't reach him because the phone was busy. So we had that funeral. My grandfather's funeral was conducted by Brother Ernest Wylam. Brother Norby had my grandfather's funeral. After my father and brother were immersed in Minneapolis, we began going to the Minneapolis conventions every year. So from 1941 on, we began going to Minneapolis. Soon I made quick friends with two children of my own age, Michael Nakora and his brother Neilan. They became my closest buddies in the Bible Study Movement. Because I came from a very small town, where there was no class at all, I was very shy among the Bible students. I did not act among Bible students. And thankful to Michael, I had somebody to help me learn the ropes. Michael and I used to play games in the back room when the convention went on. And then we were able to drink coffee. We had a great coffee drinking contest, so you could drink the most coffee in a meal. And we would set the table. And it was about 1943, approximately, convention meeting hall. I was just sitting on a side seat all by myself, nobody else in the auditorium, when one of the speakers, Brother Leo Poskanka, now better known as Leo Post, walked in and sat down beside me, put his arm around me. He knew who I was by this time. He said, "Carl, what do you think of Gideon?" And I looked up and said, "Who's Gideon?" And he told me the story of Gideon. And he made it so fascinating. All the way back, 200 miles from Minneapolis, Arizona, Iowa, I kept quizzing my father about Gideon, reading the Bible about Gideon to him, trying to figure out who Gideon was, who he represented. His brother Leo planted all these thoughts in my mind. That's when the truth first began to have a meaning to me. It first awakened my interest at about age 9 or age 10. I believe it was the next year, one of the speakers of the Minneapolis Convention was Brother Daniel Morehouse in Chicago. He gave a talk, public talk, about the kingdom. So you know the kingdom, they're going to buy refrigerators. Bread, and 2-0 is a pound of steak. I captivated. How could you buy anything with nothing? And so I was interested what the kingdom was all about. And I began inquiring about the kingdom. And that was my first interest in the kingdom. Was that talk of Brother Morehouse. Brother Norby kept encouraging us to make wider contacts. I got to one meeting a year, and that was in Minneapolis. I shouldn't really say that. There was another class, a class we went to sometimes. A class of brethren who were connected with the brother Lardon from England. Lord Lardon's views were very similar to those of the Stand Fast Movement, also the door closed, but were firm believers in witnessing. The elder of this little class was Brother Helmut Olke from Farmersburg, Iowa, and he met with Brother Sister Strelo from Monono, Iowa. So my father and I would go there for the meetings for a while, but we always got discouraged because there was so much bickering. Over the truth, they saw things different than my father saw them now with the door open. And so after about 4 or 5 meetings, we would stop. But I became friends with the Olke and Brother Strelo and liked them very much. And every year, Memorial would have Memorial with them at the Strelo home. During the same time period, my uncle, as I said, had married Ruth Wickersheim. Ruth was not a Bible student. My uncle did not want to disturb the family relationship, so he didn't talk the Bible with her. He would come to our house and I remember even my father talking about the Bible about the hour, but never really talked with his wife. We owned a little appliance store in our town of Elkader, and one day Ruth got quite sick with the flu, so she had to be in bed. And when Amos came back from work, they noticed that his dresser drawer had been opened, and that's where he kept the volumes. And the vial was taken out of there. And he asked his wife about it. Well, she said, I've been reading that book. That's interesting. And she started reading the books more, and she became a Bible student, consecrated. And we had a little group of four. My uncle, my aunt, my dad, and myself. In 1950, my father remarried. He married a sister, Estelle Sorensen, was Estelle Jones. Her first husband, a carpenter, had died in building O'Hare Airport, and she was a teacher. Dad was a carpenter, and his wife was a teacher. They got married, and she had two sons. O'Hare was a freshman, and they moved back to Iowa after the marriage, and now we had a class of six. We had my father and my mother, my Uncle Amos and Ruth, and we had Charlie and myself. During this time, my Uncle Lloyd, who had been a concert objector during the war in Pocatello, Idaho, as a cook, later a dairy tester in Iowa, decided after SEAL service to work as a cook at the Dawn. He worked at the Dawn for many years, and while he was there, he met Elizabeth Dugala, who was also working there, and they got married, and in about 1951, they moved back to Iowa. And so we had a class of eight. And then we began having formal meetings. And I remember one meeting we had every week was a question meeting. Bring any question you wanted, we'll discuss the question. And as a child of, well, that time, probably 15, I was very much encouraged to participate, as was Harold. I still remember my first question. It was on Genesis 49, where it says, Reuben shall be unstable as water and not excel. What does that mean? Where does Reuben fit in the picture? And we had a good study on that. And I appreciated the way that as a child, I was always made a part of the studies. Going back to my childhood and the Bible study movement, during these years from about 1942, the next 10 years, pilgrims from the Dawn would stop by. These pilgrims would include Brother Zano. Brother Zano was the pilgrim largely used in organizing classes throughout the country, especially in Canada. And Brother Zano was always on the road doing follow-up work and giving discourses. But he'd always take a week off, a week's rest and relaxation, and that was always in our hometown. He said, I like it here because I don't need to be served fancy food. You'll serve me sauerkraut. You'll serve me a hot dog, whatever. He said, you just make it simple. And he loved to fish. And he spent the week fishing. We lived right on the river. He still loved to come home from school and talk to Brother Zano. Because he could talk to children just as easily as he could talk to adults. Very, very good. Another pilgrim that came through was Brother Jack McCauley. Brother Jack had a voice that was, to me, very reverent. It was a holy voice. Now, he did not like children. But because I was interested in the truth, he would talk to me. And he led our first Bible study. A study I'll never forget. We were going to start Tabernacle Shadows. And the study he led was not about Tabernacle Shadows at all. It was about why there was a tabernacle. About how they came out of Egypt. He didn't go through a book. He went right to the Bible. And it fascinated me. My interest was increasing in the truth. Another pilgrim that came through was Brother W.T. Baker. Brother W.T. Baker was from Withy, Wisconsin. He had only one leg. One leg had been lost in an accident. And he was a very stentorian type speaker. He would speak very authoritatively, this is the way it is, but also very loving. And there was a little class up there in Withy, Wisconsin. There was an older sister, a Sister Hockey. Her son had moved to Guttenberg, Iowa, which is about 10 miles, 15 miles from Elkader. And she would come out and spend some time in him. He owned a little restaurant there up on the hills overlooking the Mississippi River. And whenever she was there, she was part of our class. And she became my first spiritual grandmother. I also owe a brief tribute here to our neighbors. I should give at this stage. Our neighbors were not Bible students at all. They were a good family. They had bought their house from my grandfather, and we had moved to another house. And because my mother had died when I was born, my father had a problem. How do you raise a son alone? As long as my grandmother lived, she was my surrogate mother. She took care of me. But she died when I was 7, 8 years old. And so now he again has left the problem. He worked at that time as an accountant for the Anderson Lumber Company. He said, I can't raise a son and work full time. So he got a job driving a gasoline truck. This was during the war years for Standard Oil. And he would drive his gasoline truck, and that way he could take me with him. And I was always his companion. My father, I must mention, was never a father. He was always a friend. He raised me as one to talk to, like equals, even from as early as I can remember, when I got my spankings. But he could be disciplinary, but he also could be a close friend. If we boys were in the yard playing football, he'd come out and play football. If we were wrestling, he'd come out and wrestle with us. Let us all wrestle him down to the ground. Whatever we were doing, he was a part of it. And so he would take me in the gasoline truck. But now he entertained a growing boy. And so he entertained me. He'd play memory games. He made me memorize all the counties in Iowa, all the county seats in Iowa. I had to memorize all the states of the nation, all the capitals. My uncle gave me an atlas. I had to show where all the states were. My favorite puzzle was a puzzle of the United States, putting the states in place, getting used to them. It was great for building the mind. Every summer, he would try to send me out to an uncle or aunt on the farm to get a week away to have other experiences. And 2 days later, I would take the mail truck back home because I was afraid something might happen to my dad. I knew when that happened to him. I had to be around to protect him. So I always would come back. And he would tell me many Bible stories. One of the books he would read to me every year was The Son of the Highest, also The Ten Camels. I went through those books year after year. And every year in The Son of the Highest, when it came to the crucifixion, I would cry. And I kept hoping, maybe next year it'd come out differently. And I realized the same book, it had to come out the same, but I hoped anyway. I had great hope. Go back to the Minneapolis Convention now. The brethren, it encouraged my father to broaden his spectrum and go to other conventions. So our first venture away from Mankato, other than Minneapolis, was the Chicago Convention 1946. Remember, we stayed at the home of Brother David and his new bride, Sister Florence Nimitzky, in Gary, Indiana. That convention was an eye-opener to me. I really enjoyed the convention very much, even though I was only 46, 11 years old at the time. I came back in 47, and that was the year my dad met my new mother-to-be, and that was the year we stayed at the Ted Trinus home. And after that, we always stayed at Stella Soros' home, because by this time, they're getting serious. In 1947, my father decided it was time to try out the General Convention. That year, the General Convention, which had been held originally in 1939 in Lake Waupaca, Wisconsin, and 1940 in Empress Forest, Indiana, and 1941 in Chautauqua, and 42 Chautauqua, Ohio, and then it was canceled because of the war. Rationing was such that you couldn't get there, and so there was no more convention until 1947. 47, the next convention, it was in Brooklyn, New York. In 1947, the trip to the General Convention was one of the most memorable experiences of my life. In our car was my father, my Uncle Lloyd, and myself, Sister Mary Sue Dolan, later Guzik, Sister Dorothy Dolan, her sister, and Sister Viola Schultz, later to become Sister Viola Dolan. Sister Viola Schultz was a crippled sister of elderly years. And we took the trip together. Mary Sue Dolan, Guzik, took a special interest in me. And she decided to play games with me all through the trip. On going out, she had me memorizing all the hymns I could memorize in the hymn book. I memorized what number they were, and as many words or many hymns. And my Uncle Lloyd loved to sing, and so he would sing the hymn, and then I would learn the words as he would sing the hymn. On the way back, she took up the manna. I was to learn all the manna texts I could learn. So I got to learn the manna well. And I was at the convention, she had given me a manna, and she dared me. She loved to dare me, and I loved to take a dare. She dared me, get as many names of the manna as you can. I think I had about 40 names of the manna, 15 names of the manna before the convention was over. During one of the intermissions, before that, she mentioned, she also gave me another dare at the convention. She said, I bet I could sit in more talks than you could sit in. Well, that wasn't going to go by lightly. And she missed one talk, and I missed none. So I beat her that dare. So her second dare was, I bet I could take more notes than the talks you could take. Well, she did, but I took a lot of notes. Every talk, I had, two, three, four pages of notes on talks that I would listen to and take. And then my uncle bribed me. Told Uncle Stein, when he gets home, I want you to promise your nephew, if he types those notes up for you, that you'll give him a typewriter. And give him a typewriter with red and black ribbon. And have him look up all the scriptures, type the scriptures in red, and type the rest in black. So I had to go home and type all these notes, and I had to look up all the scriptures. So he went to the scriptures word for word. And again, it was there to get my interest aroused, and my interest was rousing fast now in the truth. At that same convention, one of the intermissions, I was at the water fountain. An old brother from Flint, Michigan, Brother Dietrich, came up to me. And he asked me the question he used to ask everybody. Son, how long have you been consecrated? I looked and said, what does consecrated mean? He wanted that question asked. Give me a lecture on it. It was interesting. It sounded very reasonable to me. The next talk was by Shorty DeGroote from Grand Rapids. His talk was on the Pearl of Great Price, consecration. By this time, I was thoroughly involved in consecration. So I went to one of the older brothers that I trusted, knew very well by this time, Brother Ernest Wylam. Brother Ernest Wylam had been a pilgrim for Brother Bussell too. He had been an elder, one of the founding elders, they called the class. And I asked Brother Wylam, I said, Brother Wylam, what's consecration about? And he said, well, Carl, I'm going to give you a list of articles to read in the reprints. And then we'll discuss it at a Minneapolis convention in about a month and a half. And we'll talk about consecration. I said, read these articles first so you know what you're talking about. So that was fine. And it got easier when I got home. So I got back from that convention and Sister Viola Dolan Schultz had given me a present to thank my father for the trip, taking the trip. She gave me a set of reprints. Just at the right time of my life. I was in eighth grade. I would run home from school every day. Couldn't wait to get home to read reprint articles. I kept an index in the front page of the tower of every article I'd read. The title of the article, some thoughts I'd gotten from the article. Read all the articles in consecration. And by this time, the truth really, really appealed to me. At the Minneapolis convention, never forget that convention. One of the friends I had met at the convention in New York was Brother McTilton. He was from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Duquesne, Pennsylvania, actually. He used to love to tract, the tracts and all the buses. Sit in the back seat, the tracts on all the buses, and watch people's reactions. See which ones read the tracts. And the guy got thrown on the floor, he'd go back, pick up those, put them in the bus again, and the seat, reuse them. He was a speaker at the convention. And he's a pulpit banger. He would bang the pulpit in the middle of the talk. The talk was in the basement of the Nicolet Hotel in Minneapolis. And there was a ballroom in the basement. And he banged the pulpit. The jukebox in the back went off. I was in the middle of the talk. How come the jukebox music? And it woke me up. It was a little sidelights. But I talked to Brother Wylam about consecration. Didn't talk to my father about it. I just talked to Brother Wylam. Thought about it a lot. The next year, 1948, we came to the Chicago Convention again. I very interested to listen to the discourse in consecration. At the end of every consecration discourse, we ask, are there any candidates that wish to come up? And much to my father's surprise, I think a little to my surprise, I got up and went to the front. And I was immersed with about eight other candidates. I remember the Frank Nemish, Strands Wallen, and we're calling any of the others were immersed at the time. But I was immersed. After the convention in Chicago, we went immediately to the Dawn. They needed repairs done. My father was a carpenter. He took the summer off. Took me out to the Dawn. And that was a very memorable experience also. At the Dawn, we stayed in the upper floors of the plant. There's a room up there large enough to get a house several brother than a cots. And every night, there'd be a Bible study. Either Ken Rawson or Ralph Gaunt would lead the studies. And Ralph Gaunt led the study the one night. In fact, the first one that we went to there, it was on the Beatitudes, Matthew 5. I had a comment by my father given me. As a child, one of the problems children have, naturally, is bloody noses. I was so involved in the study, by half of the study, I looked down, my Bible was full of blood. My nose was dripping blood, and I didn't know the whole time. George Chittick shows that Bible today. I gave it to him later. But that was very memorable to me. The whole time of the Dawn was very memorable. It was a landmark experience. A little sidelight here going back to my early trip to the Dawn, the 1947 convention. Raised in Iowa, one thing we never saw was a black man. We didn't have them. I never met one. Never saw one. So we got to the Dawn about 11 o'clock at night, walk up to the upper room, and there's this black brother in Houston, Texas, laying down there. And he wakes up with this big smile and greets us. And I look, and all I see is a white sheet and white teeth and no body. What is this? Okay, going back to 1948. In school, my record in school in Iowa had not been the best. Academically, I was a straight-A student. I was second in line for valedictorian, didn't quite make it. But I was right up there at the top of the class, class president my junior year. But my deportment grades were always straight D, because I was totally bored. I'd get my work done, I had nothing to do, I'd play games, lead strikes, organize difficult times with teachers, and I'm telling you, get in trouble. I recall one teacher got so mad at me, she kicked me, and I grabbed her foot, and she went down. I got almost expelled for that one. Another time, I did get expelled. In my high school years, I took a job for the local newspaper, and that was a great job. It prepared me for my career for life, because they taught me how to write articles, they taught me how to take pictures, they taught me how to set type, everything in newspaper. I learned from the bottom up. I had to oil the press. In fact, one of the experiences I had there that was a rather funny experience was one day I put together the front page of the paper, and it was the old type where you used lead type, and you had to use coins you tightened up to hold the types, and you lift up these 70-pound forms and carry them to the press and put them down in the press, and they print the paper. So I had the front page all made up, and I picked it up, and I hadn't tightened the coin tightened up. Whole front page over the table. And boss said, okay, put it back together. You got half an hour. Well, fortunately, I could retype pretty good by that time, and I was putting it back together real fast. Only made one mistake. On the front page, there were two pictures side by side. The one picture, out in Iowa, you can imagine this, there was a picture of this bull that had won the state fair contest, prize winning. And on the other side was a picture of the mayor. And I reversed the pictures. And so under the bull's picture, it says, Mayor gives speech. And under the mayor, it says, prize winning bull. And the mayor was our next door neighbor, which didn't make it any better. Fortunately, my boss caught it for 5 copies, and I just gave the mayor 1 copy. So here's tomorrow's paper. He looked at it, his eyes got big as saucers. So anyway, I did not have a good record in the department. Well, so same about the paper. So I was editing the school paper. Now, school in those days was quite different than school today. Much more puritanical. Every year, the senior class would go on a class trip. So when the class was ahead of me went on their class trip, they went to Wisconsin Dells. And one of the boys sneaked on board the bus a 6-pack of beer. That was really a no-no. And they were all marked on the records for violation of school laws. And I was curious. I thought, this was for a small thing like that, that was a big injustice done. So I wrote a scathing editorial for the paper, the school paper about it. Well, everything had to pass through the superintendent. He took that out right away. He said, no, that's not going in the paper. This is justified. So meekly, I took it out of the paper. But I also worked with the printer that printed this. Down the paper, I put it back in. I got expelled. Expelled for 2 days. Let's go for that trick. So listen, deportment-wise, that was not good. I came back from that 3 months, the dawn, my consecration, and my teacher said, I don't know how you did. You got an A in deportment this semester. I never had before. My character just turned right around. And that lasted for exactly 6 weeks. Then I got D's again. There was a high school career. I didn't have the willpower to apply. I was very active in high school in many activities. I was a basketball player, center of the team. We had a rule on our team that the top scorer in any game was the captain in this game. So it would be McGregor in a game, and top scorer. So I was captain the next game against a little town called Fayette. In that game, I was a low scorer. I scored -1 point. Didn't make a basket the whole game until the very last second. They had a free shot. They missed it. I tipped it in. They won the game. If I hung, they shaved my hair. I got the name Hairless after that in school. They shaved my head. Took me down, and I had it to parts of the school was concerned for a while. But my favorite activity was acting in plays because that, again, was building memory. And I was in every play they had. Two Brother Dozen, Arsenic and Old Lace, and other plays. And I loved acting. So I decided after school I was going to go on and become a professional actor. And I checked out colleges for acting. Cornell of Iowa, the University of Iowa, Iowa State at Ames. But the Bible study movement at that time was very strong against Bible study going to college. Every one of them was arguing that I was going to get an evolution, I was going to get all misled by higher criticism. And I shouldn't go to college. And they convinced me. So I graduated in 1952. In 1952, I decided that I wanted to go to the Dawn to work. I skipped college, I just worked at the Dawn. Went to the Chicago Convention again, got on the train for New York, and my partner on the train is Brother Peter Collin. Brother Peter Collin was a real strong person for the purity of the truth, importance of witnessing, very strong. And much to my surprise, he spent most of the trip saying, you've got to go to college. He's the last person I expect that advice from. And his reasoning was, I'll never reach people with college educations. I never had one. Most of my sons have. Your generation must go to college so you can talk at the level of those there today and witness to them at their own level. But by then it was too late. I was in Sign of the Dawn. I adore Gene Burns, and Gene was very strong against college. Gene convinced me still not to go. I arrived at the Dawn early month of June, 1952, and was put to work in the bookbinding department. I didn't have the skills really for that work, so they soon learned that, and they shifted me to the shipping department. And that's where I spent my time at the Dawn. On the way out to the Dawn, stopping in Chicago, I was given a follow-up name in Brooklyn to call on. Person supposed to be quite interested in truth. So my first Saturday in New York, I went to call on this name. It was right under the Brooklyn Bridge in the slum section of Brooklyn. Person was not really interested. I called him by 7 o'clock in the evening on a Saturday evening. And I was so captivated as a small town boy with this big city of New York that I walked the streets of New York all night through Chinatown, Greenwich Village. I'd see bums sleeping in the sidewalk. I'd look at them and walk over them and walk around in areas that I could have been killed, drug dealing areas, everything else. I got back to the Dawn about midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning. Next morning, Brother Krupa, who was manager of the Dawn, called me in. He said, Carl, where were you yesterday? And I told him, he said, don't ever do that again. That is so dangerous. Brother Krupa was manager of the Dawn when I was there, and Brother Leon Norby was assistant manager. There was friction between the two of them. And so there was some tense years. A lot of young people working at the Dawn. People just a little bit older than I was. Ken Rawson, Gene Burns, Julius Bednarz, Art Cook, George Wilmot, Dick Salyers, Richard Sirasi, and maybe one or two more. John Guzik would come in the weekends from Pennsylvania to work there. And then their older brethren who became our mentors. Brother Charlie Smith, Brother Fred Bright, Brother Woodworth himself, and then of course Brother Norby and Brother Krupa. Tim Krupa was a little bit younger than I was, and he was there also. The first weekend I was there, second weekend, we went to a convention, my first convention out east in New London, Connecticut. We stayed with a newly married couple, Paul, Mary, Molly. They were still Molly and Guajo at the time. I remember looking at the place across the street from them where they lived, and I asked them the next day, I said, what's this paisa I see advertising across the street? Pizza, I found out was the word. But I had no idea how to pronounce the word. I never saw the word before in my life. My first experience eating live clams. Yeah. My first experience sleeping with another brother in the same bed. I slept with Charles Thornton. And poor Charles woke up in the morning with me on top of him. I rode right over. So it was an interesting convention. I remember Brother Gonchevsky's talk. It was one I really enjoyed. It was on best is on the honor and best is on the dishonor. One of the things I did at the Dawn that was so helpful to me in my Christian life, was I decided every night when I wasn't out of the Dawn, I was going to study one subject and write 1 3-by-5 page of my notes on that subject. And by the time I was finished, I had about 80 subjects that I covered during that period. So it helped get me started in regular Bible study. I didn't care for the building the New York class met in. They met at a Swedenborgian church, which is very dark, and I can almost see spirits coming out of the walls. Church I didn't care for. So I went to the Patterson class. And even though I was only 17 years old, I was made a deacon right away in the Patterson class. And you know, my first deacon symposium that year, Richard Sirasi and I were on together. And the way they handled deacon symposiums there was after you give the talk, the class would criticize the talk. And so you get the comments from the class. So I remember my subject was to the pure, all things are pure, based on a scripture of Titus. And Brother Stratford, an old brother in the class, said, Brother Hagensick, never read a talk again. And I tried never to do it again. I tried to give my talks either for notes or memory. The year I was in Washington was 1953. That was the year, first year of the presidency of Dwight Eisenhower. Eisenhower decided that he wanted to cut the cost of government. So it was a big reduction in force. And all of us new workers got laid off, and I was laid off. So I went down to civil service to try to find a new job. I had been working for the Department of Commerce at the U.S. Coast and Eugenics Survey as a clerk at a grade 3 level, which is back then was $2,900 a year pay. A lot more than $25 a week I was getting in Iowa. I went to look for new jobs then. Well, they told me that they had several openings.
that I could qualify for. And the first of these openings that he offered me was to be a chauffeur for a general to travel over the country. I knew my kind of objection stand was coming up. I said, no, I won't take that job. And the second one was a dream job, one I've often wondered if I should have taken or not. It was a job as an ensign on a U.S. Coast Guard ship surveying the coast of Alaska. And I would have been on the coast of Alaska for 2 years, taking notes on the coast, and it would have been a fascinating job. But it started just before the General Convention. And I never missed a General Convention, and I didn't want to miss one. So I turned it down because of the General Convention. And this was my year in the world. That was one thing I didn't want to interfere. At the same General Convention, I got my notice to report for my final hearing, pre-presidential hearing. So I asked my boss at the U.S. Coast and Genetic Survey if I could have the afternoon off for the hearing. He said yes. And I went down, and I'd asked Brother George Walters to go with me. The hearing was set for the day after the General Convention, the day after they get back. So I talked to Brother George Walters earlier, and he said, I'll meet you down there. Don't worry about it. I went down for the hearing, and it was a very interesting hearing. Brother George Walters, one of the elders in our class, had been from Mattoon, Illinois. And back in 1917, he'd been tracting with an older sister. They were putting out a tract about the fall of the present world order. On those days, we were caught up in the war fever. Everything was the war. And so every town had vigilant committees. These vigilant committees would be there to attack any people opposed to the war. And of course, he was, and the tract was. So he was getting haircut at the time, and the head of the vigilant committee, he was telling this to the hearing officer, head of the vigilant committee looked in, and he said, cut deep. He was getting a shave. He said, you ordered to prepare before the vigilant committee as soon as your shave and hair got done. So I got up to the hearing room and they said, brother, one of his tracts, do you admit passing of this tract? Yes, I do. Do you admit that this tract teaches sedition to the U.S. government? No. Reached in his pocket, pulls out a bunch of tracts. Here, take one, read it. Pass that tract right in the room. And said, if you can find something there, convict me, convict me. Well, they couldn't. So they finally said, well, don't ever pass these out again. We'll let you go this time. But that town had been famous for lynchings. This is still before mob order still reigned. And the famous lynching place was the alley in Mattoon. So one of the voices in the crowd cried out, don't worry, he won't get past the alley. But he asked his brother at the time to go with him. His brother was a professional wrestler. His brother said, no way will I go with you. His brother was not a Bible student. So George said, well, I'll have to go alone. He got down, he saw the crowd, he saw the rope. He just stopped for a second, said, Lord, lead me through it. And little sister, who had been his companion tractor, came out and said, we're going to go through this together. And they came, and the crowd just surged forward and stopped and went home. George Walters' brother, by the way, Edmund Walters, is the one who wrote all the phrenology reports in the Odyssey of Messenger. He read head bumps. He was also a Bible student, but two of the Walters were. But George Walters was a very fascinating elder to me. He had a painting, he was a real estate salesman. He had a painting over his desk in Alexandria, Virginia, Chart of the Ages, in vivid color. And then he had a roll-top desk, all kinds of booklets on the desk. Anybody would come in, they'd look at his chart, and he said, you know what that is? And he explained the chart to all his clients. And then whenever they were interested, he'd get the right booklet out and give it to them. And he witnessed that way all his life. I finally went to his funeral in Front Royal, Virginia, many years later. I got to meeting that Sunday. But first, I went to work the next day. And the boss asked me, how'd the hearing go? And I said, it was rough. But Skip Nelson, the hearing officer, was quite good. Who, your hearing officer? Skip Nelson. That's my old Navy commander. Let me call him. He called him up. He said, you got your CO. I want you to know who you know. So I got the meeting that Sunday. Sister Elizabeth Hurd was a very special friend of mine, talking about her just after this. She asked me if Brother Walters had been at the hearing. And I said, yeah. It's very good testimony. She said, that man, he had a heart attack on Saturday. He was told not to leave his house. But he had promised a young brother that he would be there for his hearing, and he was there. And he never missed a meeting after that. He led the meetings. He would come, he'd take about 4 or 5 steps for rest, take 4 or 5 more steps for rest. But he led the meeting for many years after that. He loved to play tricks, too. I remember one of the first meetings I went to, he was leading the meeting. And he said, Carl, read Zedekiah 6:5. So I kept looking in the Bible for Zedekiah.
or say, Abraham 4:3. He quoted these scriptures. Great sense of humor. Another elder in Washington, D.C. at the time was Brother George Clark. Brother Clark was worked for the IRS. And he had a very good job, GS-15, which was a high-paying job at the time. And Brother Clark took an interest in me. He is the father of Sister Vrooman, as you would know Sister Vrooman. Anyway, Brother Clark would say, you know, I like to go to the convention here or there. I'm too old to drive. Would you drive for me? And, of course, that was to get me to go, because he wasn't I'm nervously going upon it later. And I would drive, and then I was wondering how I was going to pay for the gas. He said, no, I said, I'm GS-15, you're GS-3. I pay the gas, I pay the meals. So that was good. One convention he didn't go to, I wanted to go to, was Allentown, Pennsylvania. And did a hitchhike. So I had no money. So I wore my high school shirt, you know, kid high school shirt, a hitchhike. Got a truck driver, was very nice. He even bought me a meal. He said, son, you can't afford it. And then I got a car, drove me up to Wilmington, Delaware. And he drove me to a crossing. He said, you can get a ride from here. I was there an hour, hour and a half, and no rides at all. Nothing went by. Pretty soon the same car pulled up. So I got home, I got thinking, this is not a good corner. Let me take you to a better corner. Took me to a better corner, and still no rides. And then the police came by. That's what I was doing there. And I said, if I get a ride to Allentown, there's no hitchhike in Delaware. You can't do that. So they took me to the police car, and as they're passing, there's a car in a gas station. I said, that gas station is closed. I've got to check this out. So they stopped there. I know some people had a flat tire. It was no big problem. And he got talking to them about it, found out they're going to Allentown. I said, give this young boy a ride to Allentown. I'll let you go free. And so he gave me a ride to the Allentown Convention, and I got there. But coming home, I was so tired I got there. The last meeting, I went up to the balcony to hear the talk, and I fell sound asleep. I woke up, the hall was empty. Everybody had left. So I went out, and there's still something there around. And now I thought, I got to get back to Washington. I got to hitchhike all the way back. And Helen was there, my ex-fiancée. And her mother insisted she drive me back. That was one cold trip. It was ice water between us. But anyway, I got back. The other impression was Sister Elizabeth Hurd. Elizabeth Hurd was the daughter of Brother Clayton Woodworth, who was the author and the compiler of the original Bible Student Comments. Close friend of Brother Russell, one of the authors of the seventh volume. However, when the split came, he stayed with the society, and his daughter did not. And so they split. And there was a great rift between the daughter and her father. Miss Elizabeth Hurd was very interesting also in her own consecration. She consecrated, took memorial at age 5, one of the youngest I've ever heard of. When she asked her father if she could take the memorial, he said, no, you're too young. And she talked to him about it, and she understood what she was doing. So he said, well, let me talk to the elders. She met with all the elder body, age 5. And they said, well, she seems to know what she's doing. Well, Larry, Brother Russell's going to be in town. Let's ask him. So Brother Russell asked her questions about consecration. So she's consecrated. Let her take. And she stayed faithful to death at about 85. One of the longest consecrations I've ever heard of. But a fabulous sister. Her own daughter married a Jewish man and lost her interest in the truth. So she had taken me under her wing. And every Sunday after meeting, I'd go there for lunch. And I had lunch with Sister Elizabeth. And she became just a friend and a mother, a spiritual mother to me in many ways. After about 6 months, by this time I had stopped working for the Coast Museum. I worked for National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. She said, Carl, you're my son. I love having these lunches together. It fulfills a real need for me. But you're not doing well spiritually. You've got too many ties to the earth. I want you to volunteer for your conscientious service. This time I had my classification. I said, pick out some city where there's a good, strong class you can enjoy and a young sister you can fall in love with. Later in life. So I went shopping. Picked out 3 cities, picked out 3 sisters, and I picked out 3 classes. Came to Chicago. Immediately got a job at Lexington Hospital. I wanted it. They had openings. There 35 SEALs working there. The young sister, you know her better, is Donna Cook, Donna Shoemaker. We had a nice long talk. The meeting started, and we sat down. And I didn't know that Chicago had a rule at the time that you sit with the sister you're engaged to her. And she was already engaged. And he took such offense, he had a nervous breakdown. He got released from the service. He was a CEO also. The same brother that I had broken up with June Constance. I had no problem with Donna. So that was hot water. The elders called me in for an elders meeting quickly and read me the riot act. I was about disfellowship for my actions of sitting with an engaged sister, and it was a pretty shameful experience. So then my second stop was Indianapolis. That's where Margie was. And Billy Melvin Champion was traveling with me from New York. We got to Indianapolis about 9:30 at night, 10 o'clock. We went right to where Margie was at her room. And I asked her if she wanted to go out for a soda with Melvin and myself. And that did it. I forgot anybody else in the world. I knew that she was the one I wanted. I had no other question. I forgot the other cities entirely. Period. It was going to be Margie in my life. That was so an honor. I just really fell hard that day. So I stopped in Columbus on the way home, but I didn't stop there to do anything else. Pittsburgh, I skipped totally with my fourth city. But anyway, I spent the whole week trying to find a job in Indianapolis. Not a job to be found. So I accepted the Chicago job, and I began my usual 200-mile commutes to date my girls. From New York to Washington, Washington to New York, and now from Chicago to Indianapolis every other week. Oh, I was already a tour. I was already 19. But I was 20 by 20. Pretty young guy. May 54, I went to Chicago. At the general conventions every year, I started going every year. From Chautauqua to Bowling Green to Bloomington. I've spent 59 years at the general conventions that I've attended. I've missed only three. Some I only got to a few days, but I've been to almost every one of them. Every year I'd have a special best friend. But Bowling Green, Ohio, the first Bowling Green, was a very monumental one to me. There was a dormitory called Wiss House, and all the younger brethren would get together there. And there'd be about, 50, 60 younger brethren. We'd get around, and either Michael Nicor or Steve Sarasi get the piano, and we'd sing, and we'd have a lot of just singing with the group. We had some solos by Helena, and then after about 20 minutes of singing, in the back by the Ray Loop, we started a little Bible study, usually with Tom Kutkowski, Marianne Burovich, later Jim Martin's wife, Josephine Malia, now Wessel, and a few others. And Nanette Cora was in that group. She was then Nanette Cadu and her sister, Vanetta. Always a justification. That was the hot topic of the day. And these studies would start, and slowly the studies would grow, and the music would dim down, and pretty soon the whole group was all in the study. This was very good. These studies were very instrumental in my life in getting me really going into a pattern of liking study. I was still pretty young. I was only about 13, 14 at the time. But I was really enthused about these studies. But the committee, Ray Luke was a Jersey City class, and Jersey City was a no-no to the Dawn at the time. So they didn't want Brother Ray to do these studies. So they tried to get Brother Loomis to do it. And Brother Loomis did one study, and it flopped. So they got Brother Sephora. He'd come in and play a saw for us. He played some hymns on a saw. He didn't have the charisma with us either. We wanted Ray, and next year we had Ray back. We didn't care what the committee said. We were going to have Ray. It didn't revolt. I was a little bit shy about meeting most of the kids. Art Jesuit would try to get me involved, and I back off. I wanted to meet those my own age. But one I did enjoy very much was Josephine Malia Wessel. And so Josephine, then I got acquainted with the Herald, because she was from Miami, and Miami was more associated with the Herald. We would go to the convention from Iowa, picking up Brother Robert Krebs as one of the Dawn speakers on the way, and he was strong against the Herald. So I get all the strength against the Herald going down. I get softened up by Josephine. They get all the straightening out and way back again. And this went through 4 years. When I finally got to the Dawn, I still have this turmoil in my mind between these two groups. And Brother Sephora was a member of the Herald. And Brother Muir was going to be speaking at Jersey City at the Sephora home. And all the Dawn didn't want to go there at all. But Ken Ross said, "You go and find out for yourself. You make your own decision." And based upon him, I did. And I was very impressed with Brother Muir. I got to be close friends with Brother Muir. Back to Chicago. Arrived in Chicago in May of 1954 and came in at the height of some new activity. Just before I left the Dawn, there had been a push for television programming. Brother Woodworth and Brother Wilson had done the Frankenhurst radio program for over 20 years at that time. And it was doing great. They were on national television, national radio rather, ABC broadcasting, NBC broadcasting. So they thought television was not a medium they wanted to use. They were older brethren. Brother Wilson at Tupé, that was pretty obvious at Tupé. And so they said, no, television not for us. So Brother Shorty DeGroote in Grand Rapids, Michigan, decided he was going to force the issue. So he personally bought an hour of television time, live, on Grand Rapids TV. This is 52. And Brother Wilson and Brother Woodruff went out to make the program. And they tried to get the image, and they made nice image. Halfway during the program, Brother Wilson's toupee fell off on camera. So they came back humiliated. That proves it. Television is not for the truth. And I remember when they came back, they discouraged me on the house. Little side here. One of the things with the Dawn that was especially good, every night at the Dawn supper table, Brother Woodruff would ask a question and get a Bible study going for 10, 15 minutes around the table. That was really good. So I get to Chicago, and by this time there's great controversy raging between the Dawn and Brethren like Chicago and other classes over several issues. The issue of justification was a doctrinal issue that had been fomenting for some time. The Dawn was getting involved with printing volumes overseas, and the German Brethren, sensitive to the situation in their country, did not particularly want the chapter on the man of sin in the second volume. So Dawn printed an abridged edition for them. Word got out that they were thinking of printing abridged editions of all the volumes for America to get rid of the errors of Brother Russell and introduce the new truths. And so there was great unrest. And in the midst of this was the television work. And in the midst of all of this was Brother Alfred Burns from Chicago, who was sort of a ringleader for change. In fact, Alfred just in 1953, and was voted on to the General Convention Committee. He's only on 1 year, but he was the one that got him to go to Bloomington, Indiana. Brother Alfred said that there's no reason why television won't work. It's just that they were not the ones to do it. Their older brother and younger brother needed somebody with more charisma. And I thought he met Brother Lorenz. No, he met Brother Ed Fay. And Brother Ed Fay was strong with the Dawn. But Brother Fay did see the vision of television. And Brother Fay has tremendous stage presence. He's one of the better speakers that the movements produce. So Brother Fay agreed that he would consider it on one basis only, that once the Dawn got sold, Chicago would back up and stop. But to learn the ropes, Chicago started out producing 15-minute programs, black and white programs. We had programs by panels of different elders. Brother Megason gave a program individually. And we got good response. We had a lot of young people in the class. When I came to Chicago, there were probably 70 brethren in Chicago. But probably there was another 30 young people, making about 100. And every Saturday, the young people and many of the old would get together at a street corner and go tracting for the television program. We put out 50,000 tracks a week. Every week, 50,000 tracks. And after a while, the Dawn said, we can't print that fast. We can't deal with you. So we decided that Alpha started again. He said, we'll buy our own press, we'll do it ourselves. So we, all the young people put in $100 each. And that just about broke me. I remember my next check, where were the $100 going to come from? But we got $100 each in. We bought a press, housed at the Western Garage, factory written during the week by Brother Alfred, usually. We typeset it. And then those young guys would go in on Friday night, Thursday night, and print them. And ready for Friday, we're tracking. We print week after week after week. We do this. Every week, we put out these 50,000 tracks. During that 13-week period, those 3/4 million tracks went out. And we got good results. We'd get 60, 70 responses every program. We're on Channel 7, good channel. So now we're ready for prime time. We decided that it was time for Brother Fay. And Brother Alfred, with the help of Sister Lucille Wessel and a few others, wrote the script for the program, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And it was a masterpiece of writing. And Brother Fay did a masterful job of delivering. It was done very well. And the response was overwhelming. We got 200-300 responses right away, and everybody was thrilled. And the Dawn said, okay, you proved your point. We'll start making programs. But by this time, that friction had entered in. That Chicago wasn't about to drop. Already the division between the Dawn and the Chicago was getting pretty wide. One of the things that made them even wider was the initial produced, in comparison with Chicago produced, were pretty bad. They were very amateurish, very poorly done. They did not draw much response. And so there became a little bit of a rivalry between the two. That was not good. And this was in about 56, 57, in that time period. Come back to another element moving to Chicago. I decided by this time that there's one girl on the road for me, and that was Margie. And so I got to not like the 200-mile drives at all down to Annapolis. We would have our days for mainly going out and proofreading the Spanish booklets that she was translating. I was in the car, and I would read my poor Spanish, and she would then proofread the booklets. And I usually stayed about 11 o'clock at night on Sunday night and head back. 3-4 o'clock in the morning, get home Monday. Well, one day I got as far as Kentland halfway, and I couldn't go any further. So I put off the side of the road, crawled in the back seat to get a little sleep. And I woke up about a quarter mile down the road, walking down the highway, thinking I was going for gas. I was walking in my sleep for a quarter mile before I woke up. Another time I was coming in on the expressway on the south side. It was now the Kingery Expressway. I was coming in on the expressway, and I fell asleep driving. And I woke up going the wrong way of the expressway, going north down the southbound lane. Cars whizzing by on both sides of me, and I quickly got over the other side. So I had dangerous experiences during that period. So May of 55, May 14th, we got married. As the story goes, lived happily ever after. Maybe it wasn't completely true, because the first year, a lot of adjustments to make. The first year, especially for a young kid, 20 years old, you're not mature as you thought you were. I had to learn a lot. We had a session of talking things over, but we got things worked out very well. We got married in a very small wedding in our own apartment. I think it was about 25 brethren there or less that came to his family. We wanted a few brethren there, but when we invited one, we had to invite them all, so we had to give them jobs to do. So Donna Shoemaker came and played the piano, and Jim Martin came and sang, and Bob Chastain, the photographer, and Julius Bednar did the wedding. So we had those five brethren, his wife Sue. One of the main activities in the class at that time, because of the tremendous amount of tracting and the television work, was follow-up work. And this would be done in groups of five. One person would be a driver, and four would be doing the calls. We would drop two off at one name, then drop two off at the next name, come back, pick up the first two, drop them to the third spot, and just shuttle back and forth driving. And we had some very good experiences in follow-up. I was usually the driver. I was a little bit shy yet about talking to people and strangers. I didn't know quite how to do it. One of the best follow-up was Sister Flossie Shoemaker, Donna's mother. She was a little hard of hearing, and her knowledge of English wasn't the best. We were in one place, the third floor apartment. She was near the steps. The woman called down, "I'm not interested." And Flossie kept plugging up. "I'm not interested." Well, kept plugging up. She finally gets her, "I told you I'm not interested." "Well, I'm sorry you're not interesting." And then she went out and the woman bought a book. Another sister was very good. That was Sister Mary Gilbert. Mary called on family in the south side, and the woman was very abrupt. She said, "I'm not interested." She slammed the door, and Mary had her foot in the door. And Mary said, "I'm not leaving until I tell you who I am." "Well, tell me who you are and get out of here." The woman was very irate. "I represent the Frank and Ernest radio program." "Why didn't you say so? Come on in." "Well, I don't want to take you my time." "Oh, I got plenty of time." Let's talk. Hour and a half later, she took everything we had. She became a sister in the truth. Her husband became the truth. But the Frank and Sister Charlotte Coppersmith. Mary was an example of all of it. She learned to read from the Langers. She was their aunt. And I remember when Mary died, strongly she encouraged each of us to faithfulness. Even at her death door, she could hardly speak. By ear close to her mouth, so she could talk to me about how serious she was about me being faithful to the Lord. A woman of very strong faith.